Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here this morning to address issues of claim construction and inventorship standards. Mr. Schiller, my colleague, will address the remaining issues of the case, as well as the rebuttal. Your Honor, this case comes to the court and as a result of the motion for summary judgment, and it presents issues and clear errors of claim construction and the inventorship standard. Claim construction is the most important error here. In this particular case, the judge, in construing shoulder portions, used the term shoulder portions as the case was filed, not as the case issued. If you look at the judge's opinion on, I believe it's Appendix 29.
What's your point about claim construction? How does this help you?
The claim construction here is what, the resulting claim construction from the court's is one that's overly broad and excludes the contribution made by the plaintiff Wagner.
What's overly broad about
it? It encompasses the surrendered embodiments that were given up in order
Adams,
to get the patent.
You mean?
I'm sorry.
It encompasses Adams.
It encompasses Adams explicitly.
Explicitly?
Yes, because some of the embodiments that are set forward that were reclaimed extend out over where Adams' portion is over the lateral portion of the shoulder, and the claim that came that was resulted as the prosecution is one where it's only on the top of the shoulder.
How does this help you?
This helps us because the remaining embodiment that is on the top of the shoulder is what was attributed by the plaintiff Wagner.
Did the district court judge hold that the claims don't cover an embodiment in which it's on the top of the shoulder?
It didn't say it didn't cover it. It said it covered more than that. But
if it does cover the top of the shoulder and then some, then it would follow that it's broad enough to cover, you know, a lot of different things, including what I think you contend your client contributed. Right?
Well, the problem is...
Why does the claim construction matter?
The claim construction matters because if you cover all the other embodiments, redefine the term shoulder portions. And the shoulder portions then can be anywhere. And that's not what the examiner determined to be patentable. That's not what the patentee... The patentee gave up those...
So what? I mean, how does that... I just don't understand how under one construction your client's an inventor, but under the other construction isn't?
It's not an inventor because she did not invent the portions that go over the back of it or over the sides of the shoulder.
But all she has to do is contribute one thing.
She did.
In order to be an inventor. So it doesn't matter how broad the claim is if it covers things that go on the top of the shoulder, the side of the shoulder, or the back of the shoulder.
Well,
if it covers what's on top,
she's a co-inventor.
If she contributed that, her testimony is corroborated.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So now, maybe the claim construction isn't as important as you think.
Well, we would assume that the court would not construe the claim, the shoulder portions, to be so broad as to basically write her out of the patent for that contribution.
Do you want to talk about corroboration?
Your Honor, this one of the other important error that was made here is that in looking at the standard for corroboration, the court decided that it recited the proper standard that the court should use to establish what evidence would be properly prove inventorship. But what it did instead was adopt a higher standard. And if you look at Appendix 29.
What's the corroboration?
The corroboration in what the court was looking for was evidence that Wagner assisted Mr. Ashley.
What's your theory as to what the corroboration is?
The corroboration to be what's proper, which is that the evidence that a person received a suggestion at a meeting from a report is sufficient to corroborate. There is circumstantial evidence here.
It's your view that testimony that they met several times, that she left her vest invention at his house, that is enough to corroborate that she, in fact, told him that he should use shoulder portions for his invention.
Well, first of all,
that's
partially true.
Yes,
yes, it's... It is true, but there's more. But the problem with the judge's opinion is that he simply ignored the circumstantial evidence because he didn't need to get there. Because he was looking for evidence she assisted in. What, how would she assist him? She would assist him by working in the lab, helping test prototypes. That's a kind of assistance.
I think what he said was that her testimony that she contributed to Mr. Trevor's invention was Mr. Ashline's invention was not corroborated.
Because I believe he was looking for the higher standard. He didn't comment at all on the circumstantial evidence.
What do you think is the best evidence that you have for corroboration?
Well, the evidence, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. It's not just what's there, it's also what's not there. It's not just what happened, it's also what didn't happen. I mean, one of the issues that we have right here is that there was a series of meetings, this technical discussion between Ashline and Wagner, in which he described the need to have the shoulder belt located on top of the shoulder. Remember, these two individuals were working in...
I don't understand how the existence of the meetings helps you, because there's no question but that Ashline was helping Wagner with her invention. So that, and there wasn't any testimony from a third party that those meetings addressed Ashline's invention.
Well, first of all, there was no... The testimony that we have in the court, Mr. Ashline did not help Ms. Wagner with her invention. He was specifically there to help with the testing of it and the evaluation of the invention, not whether or not he should be a co-inventor. That's not true.
The question is, what evidence corroborates her testimony that she helped him with his invention?
Well, let's look at the evidence of what Mr. Ashline did and did not do. Mr. Ashline, prior to the meetings with Wagner, was insisted on having a device, a head and neck restraint system that would not require and would be independent of the shoulder belts. After meeting with and having these discussions, he changes just a few months afterwards. Now he adopts and uses the shoulder belts.
I don't understand what you're talking about. There were plenty of prototypes before and that involved shoulder belts and restraints on
those shoulder belts are shoulder portions, are not shoulder portions, that's claimed. Those are yokes that were part of the old Hubbard devices. And the Hubbard devices don't work. If you take a look, that was the problem. The problem to be solved by this patent was what would happen with the displacement of the shoulder belts and therefore the device doesn't work in multiple and offset impacts.
But Hubbard and his own and Ashline's own prototypes show channels or restraints that keep the shoulder belt on the shoulder even before any meetings between Ashline and Wagner.
Well, why would Mr. Ashline disparages these prior art devices, and he makes specifically in his testimony, he says, what's the problem with the Hubbard yoke? Well, it's the shape of the yoke. So clearly these prior art devices can't possibly go through and be just simply added on to what he had in advance. Why would he do that? Why would he add on something that he knows doesn't work? It has to be different. It has to be a different combination. And this is where the evidence that Wagner taught Ashline about the need to keep the shoulder belts in position is circumstantial. I agree it's circumstantial. There are no notebooks of anybody. No one kept any written notes on this. But the problem is, what do you do? How do you go from not being independent of the shoulder belts, having no need for the shoulder belts, to one where now you adopt and use it, and you have a structure that now maintains seeks to maintain the position of the shoulder belts in a multiple and offset crash. And the other issue, if Ashline didn't use any of the teachings or discussions with these, why did he adopt the exact same term where he had never used it before? This had never appeared in any of the prior art devices, any of the prior art references. It only appears for the first time in Wagner's safety vest, which is, again, they're both working in the same genus of automotive safety. He's on head and neck restraint systems. She's looking at child safety devices. It's clear that they could have a meeting and she can make a suggestion that well, you need to keep this here like I need to keep it in place to make this device work.
So let me understand. You're saying that because her patent application uses the phrase shoulder portions and then his application uses the phrase shoulder portions, that is corroborating evidence?
I think it's circumstantial evidence that that discussion that took place. And I think the trier of fact needs to be able to make that decision. With all of the totality of the circumstantial evidence, did she make that contribution?
Okay, we're way over the time unless my colleagues have any further questions.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Schiller.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me, may it please the court. My name is Jeff Schiller. I'll be dealing with some of the corroboration issues with which Mr. Grogan previously addressed, and then I'll be dealing with the state court claims. Your Honors, I want to go forward and address some of the issues that were raised in Mr. Grogan's argument.
When you divide the argument, you divide the issues. You're not allowed to come back and re-argue the same issue that he argued.
Okay, Your Honor, there were certain corroboration issues which weren't reached.
No. We're done with corroboration.
Okay, I'll deal with the state law issues. That's fine, Your Honor. Your Honor, there are two things which are important about the state law issues, three things that are important about the state law issues. The trial court erred in making an assumption that because Julie Wagner knew about the existence of an application of the patent, for a patent in 2010, that she necessarily knew or should have known what the ultimate patent would wind up being. That's simply not accurate. In 2010, when Ms. Wagner engaged a lawyer and sent a letter, she knew that there was an application. At that point, there were no approved claims. In fact, the claims had been rejected because they were circumscribed by Adams. In fact, what Ms. Wagner knew in 2010 was that she had a patent for the Angel Vest, that she was concerned about the fact that this new patent might tromp on hers and prevent her from selling her Angel Vest, and that the USPTO ought to be aware of the fact that this existed. She did that. She was told that it did not circumscribe her ability to sell her Angel Vest, and there were no allowed claims. So at that point, there was no reason that Ms. Wagner knew or should have known anything whatsoever about the ultimate patent that was issued. Now we get to 2012, and a patent issues at that point, which is different than what was out in 2010. As Mr. Grogan pointed out, there were changes as a result of the examiner process and the fact that there were allowances made and things were given up and embodiments were given up in the process. The result of that was that the patent that was issued in 2012 was completely different than what was at stake in 2010 when she knew about this. In that context, Your Honors, what Judge Bell did is impose a condition on Ms. Wagner that is nowhere in the case law. And that condition is that she have an obligation to continue to follow a patent which had not been issued, determine what the new structure was, determine whether or not it might impinge upon her patent, and make a claim for co-inventorship. The fact of the matter is, Your Honors, as soon as Ms. Wagner determined, after talking to Robert Levy, that there was a oneness between her patent and what was being produced by Simpson, at that point, Your Honors, there was a claim filed shortly thereafter. There was no obligation for Ms. Wagner to know or to should have known that there was a patent that she was a co-inventor of. And in fact, she took appropriate steps. In any event, Your Honors, this is clearly a jury question. What she knew or should have known is a matter of fact, not a matter of law. For the judge to make a determination based upon a letter that didn't have anything to do whatsoever with what the situation was, what the allowed patents were at the time, the allowed claims were at the time, is simply outside the scope of what it is that he was supposed to do. Your Honors, I expected to talk about corroboration, which you got to with Mr. Grogan. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal instead of two, because I'm at the end of my time on the state court claims, I wish Your Honors had any questions.
Okay.
Mr. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Craig Killen, and I'm representing the defendants here, Trevor Ashline and Simpson Performance Products. Mr. Ashline, as the Court knows, is the named inventor on the patent at issue, the 074 patent. Simpson acquired the patent, or acquired the application that ultimately became the patent as part of an asset acquisition of Mr. Ashline's company in 2010. This is a straightforward case, and the relevant evidence is undisputed. Mr. Ashline.
Let me ask you, in the figures to the Ashline 074 patent, do those show restraints on the top of the shoulder for the seatbelt?
The seatbelts are shown in figure 1. And they're fragmentary, Your Honor. There is a reference by the number 110,
but they would continue over. For example, does that show shoulder belt restraints on top of the shoulder?
Figure 6, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're not shown in figure 6.
They're not shown in figure 6?
Maybe I didn't understand the question. I thought you were asking about the shoulder belts of the vehicle.
That it does. What I'm asking is whether figure 6 shows this restraint of the shoulder belts on top of the shoulder. It seems to be item 16.
Those are the shoulder portions.
Yeah, that's the Your Honor. That's my question.
It does show those.
Yes?
Yes, Your Honor, it does show those.
And that didn't change over the course of the patent prosecution, right?
It did not.
Document.
Okay.
And so, if you've already agreed,
as the court has recognized during my colleague's argument, Mr. Ashline developed prototypes of the invention that ultimately was claimed in the 074 patent before he ever met the plaintiff.
Given that
those occurred in 2002, towards the middle of 2003, Mr. Ashline first met the plaintiff when she sought him out in August 2003. She wanted some help with an evaluation, as my colleague mentioned, of her vest idea. At least one of the prototypes that was developed in 2002 was a modification of the ubiquitous Hans device, and I would strongly disagree with plaintiff's counsel's point that the Hans device is ineffective. The Hans device is a very effective device, and has saved many, many lives over the course of its existence. And it was the main competition that Mr. Ashline had at the time.
Is the Hans device still being used?
It is, Your Honor.
Doesn't actually say.
Simpson, my client, actually owns Hans as well. And that device is still in the market. The main difference, I guess, or a key difference between what's claimed in the 074 patent and previous devices, such as the Hans device, is not the shoulder portions themselves, because those prior devices did have shoulder portions. It was well known to everybody in the industry, including, of course, Mr. Ashline, because
okay. There was a suggestion that the terminology shoulder portion appeared only after the claim amendment, but it also appears, for example, to be in the specification. If you look at 870 column 6, line 64, it refers to 16, which I was calling your attention to earlier, as a shoulder portion, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the specification wasn't changed during the prosecution, right?
That part of the specification was not changed. I don't think there were any other changes to the specification, but I know that was consistent from the time the application was filed.
So shoulder portion was used before he started meeting with Wagner.
Well, this particular application was filed after his meetings with Ms. Wagner. Or at least some of the meetings with Ms. Wagner. This application was filed in April of 2007.
Okay, I see. Okay.
But the structure that's claimed in the 074.
Do we have in the record the applications that were filed before?
I don't know if those are part of the appendix, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe that. If I may step back to council table.
Yeah, go ahead.
when you conduct these other, when you conduct this figure 9C survey. And again, this is sample data, mathematical algorithm. And the suggestion is that one skill in the art to pour through that sample data, blow it up, and without any suggestion in the art, say, I think I will just go forth into the real world and conduct a survey that matches this sample data.
I was checking to see whether the parent patents are part of the appendix. I'm not sure that they are.
No, there's not. And I think, look, if this were a...
Okay, so her theory is that there were changes during the prosecution, not of this patent, but of a parent patent?
I think the argument from opposing counsel, as I understand it, is that the term shoulder portions was introduced when this application was filed, and they're contending that that is somehow evidence of her contribution.
But the problem is the record doesn't disclose what the applications looked like before the meetings took place, right?
I don't believe that that's part of the appendix. I would also contend, Your Honor, that it doesn't matter whether the term shoulder portions was used previously or not, because of all the Mr. Ashline.
No, but it would be would have been helpful to know what the application looked like before these meetings took place, since they're claiming that there were changes to the application as a result of the meeting.
This particular application was filed after the meetings. This particular application was filed in 2007. Mr. Ashline had a series of...
So they didn't put in the application beforehand to show how it was changed?
Well, I'll let opposing counsel address that issue on rebuttal, Your Honor, because it was not something that, I don't believe that's something that we, as the appellee, added to the appendix.
Okay.
I mean, if their argument is, the corroboration is, all the stuff up until the meetings never had a shoulder portion, and after the meetings there was a shoulder portion, we would assume that they would have introduced that as corroborating evidence for her testimony that she's the one that contributed it.
I don't want to speak for their decision-making process, Your Honor. What I will say is that...
I would have thought you're familiar with the record, and they make this contention that things happen in the prosecution as a result of the meetings. The only way to establish that is to show what the applications looked like before the meetings and what they looked like afterwards and what changes were made. But you're telling me that they didn't bring that in? The record doesn't disclose that?
I did not encounter that when I was studying the briefs in preparation for this argument, Your Honor. It may be in the appendix, which is voluminous, but it's not something that we are relying on as our argument against the appeal being taken by the plaintiff.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Peterson, 2 minutes on your cross-appeal.
The district court noted, I think, correctly in its opinion that the use of the term shoulder portions is a generic term, and there's nothing impermissible or inappropriate about using that term in the patent. It's the two words are easily understood. It's part of a member. The claim element requires a member that has shoulder portions, so it's a member that has portions that are somewhere on the shoulder. And it's a shorthand, generic term. The structure of those shoulder portions, as they're referred to in the patent, was well known in the art. It was well known to Mr. Ashline before he ever met Ms. Wagner. Whether you call them shoulder portions or you call them shoulder extensions or lateral extensions or whatever term you use, his prototypes that he developed in 2002 and 2003 already had that structure.
Do we have pictures of that in the appendix?
That is in the appendix, yes, Your Honor.
What page?
That would be...
You should conduct some type of survey, but what it doesn't say is, once in the art,
It's in the declaration of Trevor Ashline. It starts at Appendix 117.
Page 130, for example.
117, and it goes through...
130 shows the shoulder function.
130.
It has pictures.
Yes, Your Honor. 130. This is the prototype that Mr. Ashline created by modifying a Hans device. And as my colleague mentioned, the Hans device has a long yoke that extends over the clavicle down to the sternum area. And one of Mr. Ashline's goals when he was designing this invention that ultimately became the 074 patent he didn't want to use the long yoke. He wanted to stop it before the clavicle so that if there was a force that was applied to the clavicle in a collision event, that it wouldn't break the driver's clavicle or be less likely to.
So he moved the placement of the shoulder belts after the expiration of one of these Hubbard patents.
Initially, the R3 device, which was the predecessor to the hybrid that he marketed, the R3 device had shoulder portions, but the shoulder portions did not extend beside the neck of the driver. They stopped behind the trapezius muscle. And when the Hubbard patent, he was threatened with patent infringement by Dr. Hubbard, and when the Hubbard patent expired in 2005, I believe, November 2005, I think, then he was free to move it back. So this embodiment that's at Appendix 130 does show the shoulder portions extending over the top of the trapezius muscles. They don't go all the way down to the sternum as the Hans device did because he cut them off. But based on that interaction with Dr. Hubbard, he moved it back, the shoulder portions back, so that they didn't extend over the trapezius muscles. Then after that patent expired, he was free to move them back forward again, without any fear of patent infringement.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. The decision below.
Regarding the issue of claim construction, I would merely state that before the district court, the plaintiff offered proposed a construction of the shoulder portions limitation that basically just took the language from the claim and then added a whole clause to the end of it. And the clause that they sought to add was to anchor or restrain the shoulder belts in a position on top of the shoulders during and after a vehicle impact. The district court properly rejected that, attempt to add words to the claim that don't appear in the claim. Nothing in the specification, nothing in the claim language.
Do you agree that the claims are broad enough to cover
Semiconductor USA for declaration of
the belt being on top, could be on side, could be on the back? You agree, though, that the claims, even if they're not limited to being on top, include being on top, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that the claims, as written, do not require the shoulder portion to extend over the trapezius muscles or the top of the shoulder.
They would include it. They're broad enough to include it, right?
Yes, Your Honor. They would include that. In that regard, I see the amendment that was made to the claim that the other side is relying on heavily.
Amendment made to what claim? When? Which application?
There was an amendment made to claims 1 and 13 of the issued patent. And really all that was
Of the 074?
Well, yes, Your Honor. So the specification was not changed, but the claim language was changed in response to a rejection based on the Adams reference, as opposing counsel mentioned. What happened was the word over was deleted in those claims, and the words on top of were substituted. To my way of thinking, if anything, that was a broadening amendment, because over would I think of over as being over the trapezius muscles, whereas, if anything, that was a broadening amendment.
The problem is you're looking to provisions
that don't relate. I think we're out of time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you,
Helen. Mr. Schiller, you have 3 minutes.
We're referring to there at least 16 different sections within the California Code of Civil Procedure related to arbitration issues, and the parties did not specify in the agreement the Title 9.3 controls.
They don't have to because it is, by definition,
so for corroboration, did you introduce any evidence about what the patent applications looked like before these meetings and how they were changed after the meetings?
Yes, Your Honor. This is a continuation in part patent. The original patent, the parent patents, were at page 920 of the record. That's parent patent 669. And at page 900 of the record, Appendix 900, which is parent patent 623. This was a parent patent that did not include, these were parent patents that did not include the words shoulder portions or any relation thereto. And
okay,
that's.
So you're, hang on just a minute. So the patent at A920 is the parent patent. So.
Parent at 920 and 900 are the parent patents to the ultimate continuation.
And the filing date of December 2003.
Correct.
Before.
Correct, Your Honor. Before there were substantial meetings, there was one conversation with Ms. Wagner and Mr. Ashline before that point, but the substantial bulk of the meetings took place in 2005. Those were filed beforehand. They don't mention shoulder portions.
But they do show restraint on the top shoulder.
They do, Your Honor, but they do it in a different context. An issued patent, as this court has held on numerous occasions, is a combination of elements. The fact that certain elements are not new does not mean that combination.
I understand, but the question is that's before us is whether this corroboration of her testimony from the evidence about the prosecution of the patent
correct.
Application. We have an application which essentially occurred before the meetings at 9:20 here. And you admit that that shows shoulder restraints, which are her alleged contribution. So I'm not understanding how the changes in the language, if there were changes in the language, help you when the very restraints that she claims to invented were already shown in the patent specification.
Your Honor, the fact that the continuation in part patents, the only difference between those patents and the original parent patents is the phrase shoulder portions and the use of the shoulder portions to connect and restrain in the case of an accident.
What about, and this patent just showed us in column 7, line 3 through 7, it says the lateral extension is 28% of distance along the driver's shoulders, and it provides a suitable placement of the shoulder strap 20 and to assist in maintaining the straight device 10 in position on the driver, particularly during angular frontal collision. Isn't that just, aren't those the shoulder portions of its
No, Your Honor. There certainly are shoulder restraints. There were a lot of shoulder restraints in the industry, as Mr. Killian points out in his opinion, in his brief. Mr. Ashline had 9 patents on safety devices, and in this case, there were the Hans devices, there were the R3s, there were a lot of different shoulder portions. Some had yokes, some had, but this particular combination of elements was new. If
what
it hadn't been new, Your Honor, there wouldn't have been a patent.
What particular combination of elements are you talking about?
The combination of elements that included over the shoulders, which are connected and restrained forward movement, as we put.
But this patent application shows that.
Your Honor, if in fact the patent application shows that and is certain, then there was no reason whatsoever to grant the continuation patent because it's nothing new. The fact of the matter is the examiner found that there was an additional patentable element here. If everything that was in the original parent patent was in existence, there's nothing in the continuation patent that adds. The fact is the continuation patent adds precisely because it deals with shoulder portions. And the fact that it deals with shoulder portions and these particular shoulder portions is what allowed for there to be an issuance. Otherwise, Mr. Killian is claiming that the continuation patent, the 074 patent, should not have ever been issued in the first place.
Is it a continuation or continuation?
Continuation in part. But the difference...
Claim scope is different.
Claim scope is different, but the difference is the difference in... The principal difference in the basic continuation in part is the shoulder portions and the way they're configured, Your Honors. Your Honor, my time is up, but I'm happy to continue answering questions if there are any others.
Okay. Hearing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Schiller.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank all counsel. The case is submitted.